I'm delighted to welcome Don Usner. He is a writer and photographer. His new book is called Chasing Dichos Through Chimayo. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 18th of November at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's really fun to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. This is an interesting and profound book to me. First of all, for those of our listeners who might not know, what is a dicho?
A dicho, you know, might be translated as a proverb. It's a little folk saying, and very common in the Spanish-speaking world, in all languages, but especially prevalent in Spanish. I find that, you know, in my travels, they're everywhere, and it's part of the legacy, I think, of Spanish speakers. I find that they like to play with language in a way that we don't do as much in English. I think in English we incorporate a lot of words, and it's a rich language for that reason. But in Spanish, there's a sort of playfulness and a tradition of using these kinds of folk sayings as part of daily discourse.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of them rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are really relevant to everyday life. A lot of them have made their ways into songs that people might know as boleros or things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you were young, you heard these in your family. You grew up in Los Alamos and Chimayo.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were thinking, oh my God, these might disappear. I better start collecting them. And it turns out your mother had been collecting them.
Yeah, my mom was just amazing because she's been doing this for years. She told me that just out of her own interest and curiosity, at a time when collecting and preserving this kind of cultural patrimony wasn't popular, she just kept notes and kept lists of all kinds of things.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, it really is amazing. She is a sort of a natural-born archivist in terms of collecting. And I haven't even tapped all the stuff that is in that resource. This is just represents another piece of it. Because she also had written down the old folk tales, the cuentos, which I put together in a different book about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And those were also from my grandmother. And as you said, they were almost lost. They were on the verge of dissolution is the term I like to use. And I sort of embodied that transition from that time when the dichos were common and everyday use and when they were, you know, very uncommon like they are now. And I saw that as a great loss. And my mom had written down what she could remember from her household. And I forget the count. It was somewhere around 289 that she could recall.
Yeah.
If I had been doing it myself, I probably would have had six, you know.
Well, I mean, I would think it's hard to just pull them out of thin air. They come up in conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the fun of them, is that if you're familiar with them, they just seem perfectly appropriate to so many situations. And that's, and you know, as Enrique La Madrid says in the introduction here, their use and being adept with them is a skill that in many traditional cultures was a gift of certain people to be able to recall the dicho on demand and apply it. And my grandmother was one of those. She was amazing with language. She grew up perfectly fluent in Spanish and English because she went to a mission school at Chimayo, first girl to go there, she started in 1904. And so she had this gift of both languages and loved to use both and to recall these kinds of things. So,
and she lived to be 103.
Yeah, exactly.
So you had a long time to have those conversations.
Ah, yeah, it was really, really wonderful. It started when I was really little. I really loved staying with her. We would take turns staying with her because she was a widow. And as I got older, I just, you know, many people, especially now I find younger people, and here I'm going to start complaining about young people these days. They seem to have less interest and patience and time, but I, over time, through my teen years and beyond, I grew more and more interested in learning from her. And so I absorbed a lot, but my grandma had a saying that I loved, which was, good memories are a thing of the past. And I don't have one. So I have to write things down. And,
right.
And that was what this was about. I could recall vague pieces and fragments and remember the joy of how they came to me, but I couldn't recall them verbatim. And so I was so lucky my mom had been doing that.
And this book has trillions of them, or at least a few hundred.
Yeah, yeah.
That are organized thematically. There's ones that are about work. There's ones that are about truth and lying, basically. All kinds of different things. When you were growing up, you were in this sort of halfway between world in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You had a non-Hispanic father and a Hispanic mother. You were partly in Los Alamos, partly in Chimayo. You saw both worlds, but you didn't internalize Spanish as much as you would have liked to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was discouraged from using it because in that time, there was a prevalent idea that it would inhibit your ability to become really fluent in English if you were learning Spanish at the same time or using
Which
Spanish.
Turns out not to be true, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and so I absorbed a lot of language and was always fascinated with it and loved the sound of it and, you know, learned to understand a lot. But in terms of speaking it, that came much, much later. And so one of the things about developing this book was, you know, there's literally thousands of collections of dichos out in the world. If you go online, there's many of them. All throughout the Spanish-speaking world, they're called refraneros, and they're collections. And they're usually encyclopedic in nature, alphabetically organized.
Right. And there's probably some from Mexico and some from Chile and some from Spain. And
yeah,
maybe some in common and maybe some regional.
Yeah, so my quest at the beginning was how to set these apart to do something a little different. And so the idea was to set them in place to kind of create a cultural context. And my first idea was to just do dichos and photographs because I'm a photographer. And I started to do that, but then a magical thing happened. I began to go to Chimayo repeatedly, often with my mom, to do these photographs. And we'd talk about the dichos, and we'd visit the neighborhoods and visit people. And so I just began to contextualize them in that experience. And that kind of grew and grew and grew until it's really not a collection of dichos. It's a story about chasing dichos, you know.
It's a story of you walking through Chimayo, and just about everybody you meet is a cousin of some kind.
Yeah, and it's just phenomenal to me. The discussions we had about that, and there some of them are in the book, and they're sometimes pretty long and complicated. But I really wanted to record them verbatim, and I did record them just with a little iPhone as we were talking. And they're incredible, the number of names and the complexity of the web of relations as it's understood by my mother and her generation and not much at all by younger generations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So really what I discovered was that this whole story became for me a journey through language, place, and identity, kind of all mixed together, you know, learning a lot about the language, learning a lot about the nuances that you find in these little sayings, and exploring the place as I never really had. Even as I spent a lot of time there.
It's interesting to me, too, that, I mean, there are places that you wanted to photograph that you wouldn't or couldn't do without permission. And then the question of getting that permission, it wasn't really about, hey, can I go photograph that? It's like, who are you? Where are you from? Oh, I knew your grandmother or your aunt or something. She sold me that washing machine that had the ringer on the top. Yeah, we still have it. Come look. And it's a beautiful thing if you are patient. And this it kind of represents to me this whole book and your journey through it, the slow pace of life, which is more natural to the day and to the seasons and to probably the way most people have lived, most rural people have lived for millennia.
Yeah, and you know what? When I started producing it, I realized, especially in the first chapter, is really slow from our perspective because my mom and I went to a house with our two really dear friends who are very old in their 80s, 90s, and taking care of one, taking care of the other. And the conversation was so you know, slow and measured and deep. But I decided to start with that because I wanted to stop readers immediately in their tracks. And I said, you know, you're not going to just get your dichos and get out. You know, this is going to be about experience with that whole environment they came from is, which is a very different pace and a very different awareness of time and life and death and relationships. It's really something that really is almost gone, and I hope that I convey a little bit of it in the book.
You know, it may be almost gone, or it may not be. I mean, I think every generation thinks that the next generation is lost, and then when that next generation turns, you know, 28 or 30, they're like, who were my grandparents? And let's get to know them, and they start doing recordings, and it just happens all over again.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. See, I won't remember anything. They'll just have to read my books if they're interested.
But it also, I mean, I guess this was the thing that was, one of the things that was profound for me about this book is that a photograph might take a 60th of a second to expose, but really it took the whole afternoon of having that conversation over coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a lifetime of you being in this family, and it took many generations of that family being in that place for that photograph to be made the way it is.
Wow, I love that idea. That's really great. I hadn't thought about it that way, but one of the things I've learned in my photographic life and really came to fruition in this book is that the reason I love taking pictures of people is because it's about relationship. And people so often think of a photograph as a taking, or as Susan Sontag says, an inherently aggressive act. And I really try and embody and teach the notion that it's about developing and expressing a relationship and exploring that relationship through this experience of taking the photograph. And for me, that meant bringing all those things to bear that you just mentioned. You know, family history, our community history, and our personal relationships, which were just remarkable. The way people there made me feel completely at home, most literally, and accepted and welcomed into their lives was just really rewarding, really amazing.
There's this one moment where I think it's when you're trying to find your way to a little hilltop chapel, and on the way, you knock on somebody's door, and they say, come in. And you say, but you don't even know who I am. And they say, that's okay.
Yeah, that was really funny. The voice came from inside, and what she said is, I said, but you don't even know me. And this was all in Spanish. And she said, but ¿qué le hace? What does it matter? Come on in. We're ready for some visitors. You know?
Yeah.
And that was, you know, one of the things I also tried to do with this book was to turn on its head this notion that's often out there, not always, that the Chimayo is a scary place, and you know, there's a lot of dark corners and neighborhoods, and to go right into those places and to walk right up to people and be real and be open and be honest, and they were almost always totally welcoming.
Well, and the totally welcoming is not all, but partly related to the fact that you do have such deep family ties, mm-hmm. and that almost literally everybody you talked to was a distant cousin.
That's true. But at that initial point of contact, they don't know that. And so I found that if I was just myself and open and candid and respectful, that it was, you know, it worked out well.
And then there's incidents like a drunken guy comes up to you and says, give me money. And you said, I don't have any money on me. Well, give me your camera. Oh, you wouldn't know how to use this. Give it to me now. No way. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did grow up spending a lot of time there and having to figure out how to relate to all the kinds of people there and learning how to call somebody's bluff in that kind of situation, and it might not have ended well, but it did in that case.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to point out is that there's also this pervasive reputation of Chimayo as a you know, scary place and as a big drug dealing center and all that stuff that goes along that's so prevalent in the media. And I kind of wanted to counter that. And the story about going to buy chili from our friend there, whose last name will never be mentioned because then you know how to get my good chili, was sort of a parallel analogy to making a deal, you know, making a drug deal. But this was making a chili deal. You know, we went in the back room and she got into her personal stash and we stuck our fingers in and tasted
Right. Well, and I guess, I mean, the thing is, and I guess that's why we have artists in our society, is that you can't sum up a place through its statistics. You can't sum up a place through facts.
Mm.
It's through a journey like this, which is photographic and narrative and full of memories and full of people, that you can start to really, I think, paint a portrait of a place which is not an unbrokenly beautiful or nostalgic or romantic portrait. I mean, there's, you know, I bristle when there's chained up dogs and things like that, and it's not a totally beautiful thing, but I think it's very real, and it gives you an overall sensory, emotional, cultural picture of a place that can only happen through a kind of deep and long-term process that you went through. You've been working on this book for quite a while.
Yeah, I've really about 6 years overall since I started to conceive of it until now when it came through finally.
Now, do you have any favorite dichos? Do you want to read some of them?
Well, I have a lot of favorites, and it's funny, people ask me that, and I usually draw a blank, but one of the ones that's been on my mind lately that I really like is es como el burro hablando de orejas. That's like the donkey talking about ears.
Right.
Somebody, you know, it's like, what's the English from? It's like the pot calling the kettle black.
Right, and, exactly. You know,
that notion that somebody has no business to be talking.
I mean, a lot of these dichos are really backhanded insults at somebody who's egotistical, let's say, or thinks they're better than they are, that kind of thing.
I noticed when I started to break them down into categories that the vast majority were about character and defining good character and disparaging bad character. And I think that was such a valued ability in the culture, traditionally and historically, to size up somebody. Are they honest? Are they real? Are they true? Are they egotistical? Another one of my favorites is él no vale ni un cero a la izquierda. He's not even worth a zero on the left side. And I remember when I was little, my grandma saying that, and I used to think, what does that mean? You know, when I was really little. And then it dawned on me, well, a zero on the left side has no value at all.
Right, like 01.
Yeah.
As opposed to if you had zeros on the right side, it goes to 100 and 1,000.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the maybe dozen that I do remember her using. And, you know, or another one that she used to use was, él piensa que no más sus naranjas valen. He thinks that only his oranges are worth something.
You right.
Know, like somebody who thinks much of themselves. And so, yeah, a lot of them were about character, and a lot of them were admonitions from older people about behavior.
And it does, I mean, taken together, you get the sense of a kind of village life where these exert a gentle social control on
exactly.
people's behavior.
Exactly. Very, very well put. And I think that that's a notion that is still really valuable. I think, you know, there were cultural guideposts. There were behavioral guideposts. And that's how they were used in my case.
The photographs, the portraits are wonderful, and you do get a sense as you're looking through the book of these people, and then you read more about them because each chapter is about the person to some extent that you're photographing. Have you presented this, or are you going to present this book in Chimayo?
I actually did 2 weeks ago, but I didn't have the book yet. But I gave a talk about it, and it was wonderful. And last summer I did a show at the Chimayo Museum, which is a fabulous place. It's in the home of my great-great-grandfather. It's a little three-bedroom, three-room adobe house. I did these portraits and many more. I think there were 60 or 80 portraits on display. And that was truly amazing because these people came to see themselves. And one of my favorites is Narciso. He's the guy sitting in the easy chair. And he's such a great character. And he has come, in fact, the museum director was telling me, he still comes back every month or two just to go see his picture on the wall. And he's one of the few I mentioned in here who's doesn't speak any English. You know, he's gotten by his whole life without English, without ever driving or owning a car. And he's still doing fine. He's in his late 90s. But anyway, to have him show up leaning on his cane with his family, that was just so rewarding. And that's really what it's all about for me, is really to give back to that community. What it's, you know, some piece of the great sense of place and meaning and the value that I've gotten out of being there.
Don Usner is a writer and photographer. His new book is called Chasing Dichos Through Chimayo. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 18th of November at 6 in the evening. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.